Okay, back to where we were. So we've just briefly gone through process. I don't think we did that on the recording. It's pretty much the same thing I said on the first call. So maybe I'll just quickly ask Sharon or Ashley to just walk you through the materials you've got to make sure everybody understands what they've got, and then maybe we'll maybe ask Tarun to briefly go through the co-chair's response if Tom hasn't joined us yet.
Okay. So, Art and Andy, I appreciate all the efforts that you took to review the voluminous amount of material that we sent you, but I wanted to just digest it down to what the key conversational points, at least my interpretation of the key conversational points, that we'd like you to focus on in today's call. To orient you to the materials, you'll see the memo sent around the process issues from Tim and Ann to the CSAC, and particularly you representing the smaller work group considering these issues. You'll also find in the attached materials the request for reconsideration that was provided by Optum, also known as Ingenix. And then additionally attached to that is the co-chair response to the concerns that were raised in the Ingenix reconsideration letter. Additionally, you'll find measure-specific evaluation summaries and also a memo from the NQF staff to the CSAC related to a policy issue that is, as Helen noted, emerged through this discussion. So to really – oh, and also an email from David Hopkins outlining some of the process concerns that he raised related to this project.
Yep.
With the responses from NQF staff and
okay, so Tarun, are we looking at the memo of the 24th?
That was sent from Helen. I actually don't have the date.
Okay, I've got one from you. I'm confused by the materials, let alone the subject. There's one from you and other staff dated the 24th that then has a lot of attachments to it.
Yeah, so the big PDF is what Tarun was walking through. He'll then go into detail, if Tom doesn't currently, on the response from Tom and Bruce, the co-chairs,
okay,
the Genix letter.
Yeah, and I don't have the PDF in front of me, so Helen, maybe you could point out the page numbers if you have it available, just to keep everybody, because I have it on print version here.
Yeah, I mean, the PDF I'm looking at is the 417-pager.
Exactly. That's it.
That's the one I'm looking at. Okay.
All right, just so that we're all on the same page. Okay, so what I'll walk through here is, I guess at the same time, I'll walk through the Optum Insight response reconsideration letter and also the response from the co-chairs on the specific issues. And really, there are two basic issues that this can be boiled down to. The Optum... Ingenix noted that they felt that the interpretation in the endorsement recommendation was primarily based on a preference by the steering committee for standardized prices or having available both standard or actual prices for measures. So specifically to give you some context, the initial measures that were submitted by Ingenix offered an option for a costing approach, which essentially translates the measure to using a standardized approach to costing or using actual prices paid costing approach. As required by the resource use submission form, the measure developers have to submit one costing approach. We did not identify, NQF staff did not identify this issue, did not identify this option in the first evaluation of these measures. And we subsequently, Ingenix was given the option of either selecting either a standardized pricing approach or an actual pricing approach, or submitting two measures, one with either approach. Ingenix chose to select an actual pricing approach, and the committee then evaluated and provided final recommendations based on that measure specification. The second issue that was identified was that the Ingenix felt that the interpretation of the failure of the four measures was primarily based on assessments of the steering committee around feasibility and usability, outlining four key points, including the measure complexity, sample size and usefulness for individual physicians, the impact of carve-out arrangements, and the cost of implementation. Now, I will, Tom, if Dr. Tom Rosenthal, if you have joined the call, I'll try to give a high-level summary of the steering committee's, the committee chair's response to these two issues, and then I will, you know, then we can open it up to general discussion, both for the for Tom as the chair, or for us as NQF staff, or any clarifying points that you two may have, Andy and Art. Also, the measure developers are on the phone too, if you want to direct any questions to them. So the primary question around the preference for the standardized pricing approach was that, the committee felt that none of the recommendations that they made was primarily driven by the costing approach, particularly a measure-by-measure decision of the appropriateness of the costing approach was driven by the measure's level of analysis, the risk adjustment approach, and many other characteristics. In fact, other measures submitted by the same developer using actual prices actually were recommended for endorsement. Two were recommended for endorsement, and one with a split vote has been advanced to the CSAC. On the issues of usability and feasibility, the committee felt, while they did consider the complexity, clearly this project and the measures submitted to this project represented tremendous complexity. However, they felt that there was a limitation in the transparency of some of the materials presented and the information that was presented by the developers. The decision of whether it was advanced or not was not hindered on the measure's complexity. It was just whether or not they were able to adequately assess the measure's reliability and validity. Issues around sample size, carve-outs, and the cost of implementation, again, while considered during the evaluation, were not single components of the measures that actually brought these particular measures down. There was a table provided in the materials, a brief review of the measure-specific review, that outlined specific issues related to the clinical logic of the measures submitted, an example being for the CHF 1591 ETG measure, there was a concern around the exclusion of diastolic failure, which is a separate ETG, and there was a concern around the appropriateness of the clinical logic in all of the measures that were not recommended for endorsement. So the basic point being, to summarize all of this, is that there was not one specific element across all of the NGENX measures that were submitted that resulted in the measures not being recommended for endorsement. There was a real measure-by-measure evaluation of the reliability and validity of the measures, and there were different issues with the different measures submitted. And so we can go into that detail if you would like to. Otherwise, I'll kind of turn it over to Tom Rosenthal if you have anything else to add to this group, if you're on the call. If not, we're happy to just kind of have you two, Art and Andy, have a discussion, and we can provide some additional clarifying information as well. Oh, and sorry. And I'll...
Why don't we let Andy and Art
have
questions
first? So are you open?
Yes.
Is this open now for us to talk?
You.
Okay. Well, it's Andy. So I'm not sure anybody can respond to this, but specifically maybe I'm talking to the folks from Optum, because when I read the letter from Optum, it seemed to me that there was some concern that these measures were not accepted, for one reason being that there was no standardized value scale or cost scale, call it whatever kind of scale you want. I mean, is that your feeling or not your feeling? Because as I understand it, other measures were approved that didn't have a standardized value.
Hi, Dan Dunn here. I'll try my best to respond to that. I think that, you know, the crux of the argument around the preference for standard pricing and the impact of the costing approach as a single element, you know, was based on, you know, actually one key assessment is, you know, these original submission of our measures, as Tarun correctly described, was based on, you know, giving people the option to use standard prices and actual prices. And people use our measures using both approaches, and I think for good reason. depending on what they're trying to do. You know, there wasn't a request or anything clear around that we actually, in our first submission, that we needed to provide a specific costing approach that was subsequently...
But do you feel you need that now?
Let me finish, please. But, you know, based on all the elements, other than the costing approach, you know, there was a vote, and this is where the steering committee voted on scientific validity, importance, usability, feasibility. You know, the CHF population based and diabetes measures were all endorsed. We then re-specified, so I'm assuming at that point that, you know, the steering committee had carefully weighed all the elements that, you know, Tarun was describing, and rightly so, they should. And then when we re-specified the measure where we described our costing approach as actual prices and we didn't submit a standard pricing one for different reasons, then the vote, you know, went from endorsement to not endorsement. That's simply what our argument is of thinking that the costing approach carried significant weight and changing the decision from one way to another.
Well, this is Tom Rosenthal. I'm sorry I'm a little late to the call. I had something run over, but I think it's fair to say that it's a little more complex than it was. Just the only thing that changed was that, and therefore the vote changed, because also time passed, and the committee, I would say, became a little more... The methodologies were not exactly trivial on the Ingenix measures, or frankly any of these you know, sort of computer generated algorithms, and it took the committee a while to figure out what the various meanings of all of these elements were. And I think that it's really on neither vote was it sort of a single element that was the, and of course I can't speak for every single individual from the committee, because we'd have to have them all here on the call to say what each one was thinking. But my impression was that every person who voted did so with a kind of holistic view of the measures, and in both votes. And the analogy I was trying to think of, we could certainly say, gosh, we have two votes on record. One was later than the other one. Only one thing changed, and therefore that's what it is, and that's illegitimate. And the other way to look at it is, I mean, the Congress has multiple votes on things at times, and it's sort of the last one that ends up being the definitive vote. And so
help me understand the process, and having not been to the actual steering committee, what was the purpose of the first vote, and then why was it necessary to do a second vote? Or is that normal? I'm not understanding that's normal process that we would vote twice.
Tarun would have to. There was, as I recall it, and is that we had specified the staff had specified in sort of the rule set a certain rule, the way that in fact the developers were supposed to respond to the thing, and I think this was Tarun, you'll have to please add in here very quickly, but we had specified these exact rules for the other developers, and the other developers had all done it the way we thought the rules were, and somehow so it hadn't been specified properly, and that necessitated the reconsideration. Tarun, please elaborate on that.
Let me just, because this is a process issue, and in fact this may, you know, again, this was NQF's first attempt at evaluating resource use measures. In the measure specifications, it required measure developers to specify a single costing approach. Again, because of the volume, and this was the first run at this, there were two measure developers that submitted both costing approaches in a single measure. And obviously, for consistency purposes, this was an agreement, even as part of the measure submission form that was seen by CSAC, that we would have one costing approach per measure. And we asked Health Partners, who is also had submitted both costing approaches in one measure, to the option of either specifying actual prices or standardized prices or both. And they chose to submit both, as you had seen in your prior CSAC meeting. we offered the same option to Ingenix. The challenge was that the committee had done a first evaluation of the measure, given both costing approaches. When they respecified the measure with an actual costing approach, that required the committee to then reevaluate the measure as specified. So, you know, again, one could consider. Actually, I'll just leave it at that. That was the procedural reason for the reconsideration of this measure.
I was just going to say, and from a process perspective at NQF, we do fairly commonly have committees revote when additional information is available. We just did this, for example, on the readmission project.
Right.
The committee, after all the information for the developers, in fact, revoted on the measures to confirm or not confirm their initial impression. So this is actually not that atypical.
Yeah, and I'm okay with more than one vote. I'm just trying to understand what prompted it. So if the measure was submitted in the first place with two different value scales, one standardized and one cost of care, non-standardized, I mean actual cost of care, other than them being split out, was there any other changes to the measures, or was it simply that time had gone by and people had learned more about the measure, decided to have more discussion, and the more discussion discovered new concerns, and therefore the vote may have come out different the next time? Is that kind of how this went?
I think that the committee definitely became more knowledgeable in this whole general. I mean, the first meeting we had face to face to discuss these items was the first time some people around the table had ever heard of any of this methodology. And so we were trying to, there was some element of kind of feeling our way around. And you saw the first vote wasn't exactly 14 to nothing either.
Yeah.
Right.
So these issues were really very, there was debate around the table as to on both sides of the thing.
Right. And just one thing to add from the first TSEC work group call, Bruce said something very similar, and we had the transcript, so I thought I might just add that as well, because it's very similar to what we just heard from Tom. It said the steering committee itself went through a learning process, in large part because this was pretty new material and a new area for measure evaluation and endorsement, so such that the committee, when it began the process early on and when it ended the process, having looked at a lot of measures of the related material, wasn't, you know, really learned and had a different perspective. And his point was the reassessment went beyond the value of standardized
right.
versus actual prices.
This is Dan. I think I can make this easy. And I do appreciate Tom's point, and Bruce had made the same point that, you know, I think part of our response here was maybe lack of understanding that that reassessment was happening from a number of different perspectives, because, you know, most of the discussion around the revote was around the costing approach and, you know, people weighing different, you know, values, citing different values to one versus the other. That was the impetus for our argument around the reconsideration.
Right.
And Tom's point that, you know, people did consider other factors, you know, is a fair one. And to be honest, tempers our comment as well.
Right, well, that's helpful. And I will say one of the issues that was a factor for some people was the notion of the attribution of dollar-denominated cost at the individual physician level at a national level. And that was a factor for some people, but I would consider that to be a sort of holistic argument and not something that was simply focused on standardized pricing or not standardized pricing.
So I'm also, it's Andy again, so in trying to read through some of, without obviously going through the real, real details of each one of these measures, I was trying to understand whether some of the, knowing that there were several points that made any one measure not get approved. It wasn't just one thing. I was trying to get a feel for whether some of the objections to these particular ones that weren't endorsed on heart failure and CAD, whether those same problems existed with the asthma. I mean, are they unique? Are they unique to CAD and the CHF measures and not unique and not included in the asthma COPD, the ones that were approved?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess asthma COPD were approved. Well, what I'm trying to understand is, because I know a little bit about this methodology, having used some of this software, and there are some common themes with all the episodes, and I'm trying to understand, was there something specific about the diseases that made those measures less enticing than the pneumonia one, which did make it through?
I think the answer is yes. Although I would be hard-pressed to, how we say, give an erudite and precise articulation of the differences. But at a 30,000-foot level, the answer is, at least to some of the clinicians around the table, certain of those conditions seem to be more obviously risk factors being able to be captured really well, and more obviously attributable to specific physicians who would be responsible for the care and who would be in the reporting of the outcome. So, and I can't remember the exact one, but CHF is, I think, a pretty good example. It was thought that, as I recall some of the discussion, that, wow, there's a whole variety of CHFs, and there's everything from somebody who's really about ready to have a heart transplant all the way down to the, you know, to the person who's got a little mild shortness of breath, and given that this is all coded data to begin with, the opportunity for there being widespread differences in clinical presentation and complexity and all the rest of that, and then attributing it to an individual physician who might or might not be taking care of that patient across the spectrum of care, meant that there was concern on the part, I think, of the committee that you would, in effect, end up misattributing a rank order at the individual physician level, which was more possible, say, on something like heart failure than and the other one I think that got turned down was coronary artery disease, which, again, the committee went, God, you know, there must be 20 different varieties of coronary artery disease. The possibility of misattribution seemed to be much, much higher than it was on one of the other ones, and I've forgotten whether it was asthma or whichever one that was approved, where it was, oh, yeah, that's likely to be one pediatrician, and it's likely to be, one doctor, and there's less variation in spectrum of disease and so on and so forth. Did we get that exactly right? I don't know, yes, the answer is yes, that factored into the decisions of why one and not another, where otherwise the methodology looks exactly the same.
There was another comment made in there, something about the risk adjustment methodology, and I thought there was a comment saying that there was an argument about whether this was kind of a circular thing, and that the risk adjustment was based on the year's worth of care that was actually part of the ETG. So my question to Optum is the risk adjustment, the ERG score, being used to the prospective one or the retrospective one for the year of the actual care that occurred that's included in the episode?
Yeah, it's actually two sides to that. So there are two types of measures that were in play here. One are the episode-based measures, which are ETG-based, and the second was an ERG risk-adjusted non-condition-specific measure.
Yeah, now I'm talking about the condition-specific ones.
Okay.
So I believe they were risk-adjusted by ERG. ERG?
There's a separate risk adjustment model for every single ETG, and so it's not ERG based. It's essentially what risk markers make sense for the for diabetes. Those are included. And I think the issue was, which I think you're getting at, was that when we identify what markers will trigger for an episode, we're looking at the history on the patient, which comorbidities are presented before the start of the episode. But we also include some factors which are observed within the episode itself. And, it's something.
So it's a combination of prospective and retrospective and comorbidities and factors.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the challenges, though, is, I think this gets back to how other measures are evaluated. That's the same approach used in some of the measures that were endorsed. I know it's a debatable point,
let me just weigh in on this one. I mean, there may be some written materials that articulate this issue. I don't believe that this was a very substantial issue in any of the deliberations.
Okay. Appreciate that.
It was discussed, but this was not one of the ones that went, oh, this is the deal breaker, and this is the basis for turning this thing down. It certainly got brought up, as did a whole number of issues surrounding how one goes about making sense out of this kind of data, but I don't think that was a determinative factor in any of the decisions for or against.
If I could, I think you're right, and I think the challenge is even within our four comments around the complexity, and so I think all these things add up to kind of a tipping point for someone to be concerned. And the risk adjustment concerns was one thing you highlighted in your note as a systematic issue. So
yeah.
To be honest, I'm not quibbling with the idea that contemporaneous factors should be excluded. In fact, I think we've been convinced enough that it's something we're going to go back and address. But anyway, I'm just commenting on both the accumulation of these things as well as our general comments in our letter.
Yeah.
So there was one other general issue that I wanted to ask about, and that is this whole idea of complexity and transparency of methodology, which I think are all related. And that is, I'm trying to understand, at least from maybe even from the steering committee, so Tom, is that there seemed to be concern that while the black box was open, it wasn't open transparently enough that to be really able to tell exactly what happens to each piece of information, what actually happens. I mean, I understand that complexity is fine. I don't mind measures being extremely complex. As long as there's enough transparency, should somebody have enough time, effort, money, and anything else in a major supercomputer that they could duplicate it if they wanted to, not to say that it's practical that anybody would ever want to do it or maybe could, but the information's there and available. Was that a factor or not a factor? I mean, it seemed to be kind of a threat through all this.
It was definitely a point of discussion and a point of pretty extensive discussion. And there were people on the committee who were concerned that the thing was too much of a black box. I think but we had a member on the committee who was very statistically minded, very savvy data person, who in fact said it several times that the NGINX material is available on the web. You would have to be pretty savvy. You would have to be willing to spend a ton of time. The average person couldn't do it, but that it was open enough in the current environment where where it couldn't be called legitimately a black box.
So
That there was enough transparency, albeit really, really difficult. And again, I would say at the end of the day, I don't think that factor, although, yes, it was clearly widely discussed and extensively discussed, was a factor and again, I can't speak for every last person. There may have been somebody around the table who, based on their own belief that despite that person saying the thing, still didn't think it was transparent enough. I can tell you from my own vote, I was persuaded that the thing was transparent enough to meet the hurdle that you just described, which
okay,
is
so there wasn't
you
any
know smart people.
There was
concern, but I don't think that was the vote, the determination of how.
Oh, no,
people
no,
voted.
I was going to say something beyond that. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I appreciate your answer. No, that was very helpful. I understand that. But was there any concern? Because there's always this other question out there that I don't know if it's where it's. If it's ever written or there's a rule around it, is to the proprietary nature of some of this that somebody couldn't, that there's a cost to actually doing this measurement because of the cost of licensing the software, and it's almost impossible that anyone could ever do it without the software. Now, I understand there's software for more than just this measure that costs, but there's cost and there's cost. Some are trivial and some are not trivial. Is that any concern to the steering committee, or was that now dismissed as not the issue?
Well, there was extensive discussion about the cost, and in fact, we had a whole section of one of the meetings devoted to that very question. And if I remember correctly, in the first meeting, we didn't have the cost number. In fact, that's why we bought it back, because we got the number, and when we had the number, then we had an extensive discussion about what did that mean. And again, I can't speak for every last person on the committee. And again, there may have been somebody who voted against it because of their belief that the cost was prohibitive. But the general discussion around the table was that the cost for the people that were likely to be using the software was not prohibitive. And again, I don't think at the end of the day, although we were actually obligated by the NQF rules to consider it and to consider it formally, at the end of the day, I don't think that the cost of the Ingenix product ended up being a factor in anybody voting against it.
Right, and this is Helen. Cost of using the measure is only considered under feasibility. I mean, it certainly didn't appear that feasibility was the driving force of those determinations. It was really
right.
Mainly
yeah, thank
about
you.
Those are the questions I had in advance. So Art, feel free if anybody else has a comment to make.
Probing, and it's really been helpful for me to sort of understand exactly what happened here, which were, you've asked all the questions I would ask about sort of what was the process, how did this start, how did the revote and the whole process, which is really what we're concerned with here, I think, Helen.
Yeah, exactly.
So what we really have is a maturing committee.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And who learns more about what its charge is over time, and when it goes to reconsider putting the measures forward for endorsement, comes to different conclusions because it has a different knowledge base that it's working for.
Yep. That's
how
I'd
summarize it.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, and this is Dan, and I think, and I mentioned this before, but probably led to our misunderstanding of the importance of that single costing element in that second vote.
Yeah, so that's right, because that really was sort of misleading in a way, because that's what one initial go around you sort of focused on that, and that seemed almost to be a foul ball. I mean, to change the cost rules midstream and change the vote, but from what I've learned today, it really was a very different happenstance. So.
And we acknowledge that, and I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, and that came up at the call early this week. So we acknowledge that is the case, and Tom described it well.
Okay.
Yeah, the only other thing I was going to point out, this is Helen, is that Christine made a comment the other day, and I think actually one of the other members as well, that in some ways the fact that the same process was followed through all the measures, and some made it through, some were a tie, and some didn't make it through, suggested that the steering committee was making a measure-by-measure decision
right.
than a decision simply based on costing approach.
I think it speaks to the fact that while the ETG methodology that backs up these measures is complex and all that, that's really not the concern of people. The concern is that it doesn't have the same, I don't know whether validity is the word, when it's used for different diseases, that there's enough difference between one ATG and the next that there's real clinical issues involved here. That it doesn't work. Just the methodology may work great for asthma, but it may not work great for CHF the way it's built today, unless it's there's
well not other... not at a national reporting level. And again, I think the other factor to keep in mind is we're not making. I don't believe the committee felt it was making a judgment about the acceptance of this measurement. For a local health plan or a statewide health plan or somebody to use as a commercial tool or whatever. But the hurdle for us was this was expected to be a national, publicly reportable item, and which set, I think, a different hurdle and bar for us than whether or not this tool is useful in some other kinds of settings. Which they undoubtedly are. They undoubtedly are. I mean, so this isn't the lack of endorsement of a specific Ingenix measure, I don't believe, says anything whatsoever about how useful the Ingenix products are overall in a variety of different settings.
Right. You said it much better than I fumbled around with it, so I hope I didn't mislead people. Thank you.
Okay.
I had nothing more.
Okay. Any other comments from anybody else?
No, just Dan, just thank you. Thank you again for both promoting resource use measures and offering us the opportunity to submit it. And carefully taking into account our recent letter regarding reconsideration. So, thank you. And actually, and just to note, I appreciate all the work Tom and Bruce and the whole steering committee did, because I usually saw this 400 pages worth of material. There's probably even more notes and declarations and things they had to go through.
And thanks, Dan. And this is Helen. As I mentioned on the first call as well, we have very clear expectations that we'll get to do additional resource use work in the coming years. So I think we can be delighted to revisit some of these going forward. I'll also just point out for the CSAC members, we also shared a memo that we put some minor modifications up to the SharePoint site today on the sort of broader policy issue that this set of measures brought to the fore for us around use of national consensus standards when they can really, when some of them may be best used at a local or regional level. I don't know that we need to talk about it today. It's just in your packet.
Okay.
I wanted to have that more as background so you have it for the discussion next week, but I think it is separate. It just made it very obvious for us that we needed to have that conversation.
Oh, I agree.
Great. Okay. Anything else? Art?
No, I'm good.
Tom.
My head is lighter than what's going in here.
I would say that's a real accomplishment of the call, then. I'm impressed.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye now.
See you next week.
Bye.